So, have you ever had that experience where you're like just watching a true master at work?
Oh yeah, like when someone is completely in the zone.
Exactly. Maybe it's an incredibly skilled artist or just a seasoned professional in your field, and you realize that just observing their silent routine is a lesson in itself.
Right, because you aren't even talking to them yet.
Yeah, but their mere presence, you know, the sheer economy of their movement, it's teaching you something fundamental.
Well, that moment before any formal instruction begins, it often carries the heaviest weight. I mean, the embodiment of a skill speaks way louder than any lecture, because you're witnessing the end result in real time.
Which is actually the perfect entry point for what we're doing today. So, welcome to the deep dive.
Thanks.
We are zooming in on exactly that kind of moment contained within this really legendary
We
text.
have a massive stack of sources today.
They do, but they all focus on just one single pivotal sequence. It's the second section, or verse 2, of the Diamond Cutter Sutra.
Right. And just to be clear, we're not attempting to summarize the entire text today.
No, not sure.
Instead, we're looking at commentaries from different masters across centuries just to unpack a single fragment of time.
It's literally just the exact second a student asks a teacher for guidance. But it sets off this whole spiritual revolution.
Yeah, and the commentators, they universally view this single verse as the hinge of the entire sutra. Like, it acts as the critical bridge between the silent, physical world of daily life and the absolute highest peaks of philosophical wisdom.
I really want to unpack this thoroughly because we're going to look at the physical, the ethical, and like the ultimate layers of simply asking a question.
And it's so relevant today.
It totally is. The way these commentators break it down absolutely applies to our modern quest for clarity and focus. But before we get to the actual words that were spoken, we have to understand the profound silence that preceded them. Like,
Right.
what is actually happening in the room?
So to set the scene based on the historical commentaries, we have this figure named Suputi, and he's the elder disciple. He's observing the awakened one. But he isn't watching him perform miracles or anything like that.
Right, no fireworks.
Exactly. He's watching him perform completely ordinary daily tasks, like begging for food in the city, walking back, washing his feet, and just sitting down.
Okay.
But the defining characteristic is that these totally mundane things are being done with total unattached awareness.
And the commentaries make a huge deal out of this contrast. I know there are like several perspectives on this in our sources, but how do they describe the difference between the master and everyone else watching?
Well, the Zen master Hunang provides this brilliant commentary on what Suputi was actually seeing in that assembly.
Okay, what did he see?
He points out that Suputi was surrounded by people who were just incessantly busy. Like Huining describes the minds of the crowd as being, and this is a quote, like so much dust in the air, their minds in turmoil as if blown about by the wind.
Wow.
Yeah, they're constantly moving from one anxious thought to the next, just never resting.
I mean, we can all relate to that mental state. It's like the swirling dust of emails, obligations, anxiety.
Oh, for sure. And sitting in stark contrast to that swirling dust is the perfect silent routine of the teacher.
Right.
The everyday routine was a silent teaching. The awakened one didn't need to, open his mouth to demonstrate the perfection of wisdom. He was living it by just putting on his robe and holding his bowl with absolute presence.
So it's exactly like watching their master craftsman I mentioned earlier.
Exactly.
The craftsman is just arranging his tools, sweeping his workbench, moving with complete intention. And you, as the apprentice, you're just watching this in complete silence, realizing that the presence itself is the lesson.
Yeah.
But eventually, you have to break the silence. You know, you have to ask, how do you do that? But why is the contrast between the turbulent crowd and the silent master so crucial to the specific question Suputi is about to ask?
Well, Suputi is seeing the ultimate goal perfectly manifested, right? While simultaneously seeing the dust of ordinary human distraction all around him.
So it's the contrast.
Right, the contrast acts as the catalyst. Suputi realizes that everyone else wants that peace, but they lack the mechanics to achieve it.
They don't have the tools.
Exactly. They don't possess the internal framework.
Oh.
So he steps up to bridge the gap between the silent realization of the teacher and the turbulent minds of the students. That shift from observing silent action to a deep verbal exploration of how to actually achieve it, that's what makes verse 2 so pivotal.
Okay, let's look at the actual moment Saputi steps forward because he doesn't just like raise his hand from the back of the room like a student in a lecture hall.
No, not at all.
The commentaries heavily analyze his precise physical movements before he even speaks a single syllable.
Yeah, the choreography of this moment is incredibly deliberate.
What does he do?
The text tells us that Saputi stands up in the assembly. Mm-hmm. He uncovers his right shoulder. He sets his right knee on the ground, and he respectfully folds his hands.
I have to admit, my immediate reaction to reading that was, well, skepticism.
Really? How so?
Well, does the physical posture really matter that much for a purely mental practice? Like, it sounds a bit formal and rigid for a philosophy that is famous for non-attachment and emptiness.
Right, yeah. Modern readers often bump up against that formality. But the commentator, Chang Weinong, unpacks the deep mechanics behind this symbolism.
Okay.
Every physical movement is a deliberate purification of what he calls the three sources of karma.
Okay, let's pause there for a second, because karma is a pretty loaded word. How is he defining karma in this specific context?
Good question. Mm-hmm. So in this framework, karma isn't some like mystical cosmic payback system.
Right.
It simply means action or volition.
Right.
We interact with the world through three avenues, basically. Our body, our speech, and our mind.
Okay, that makes sense.
And most of the time, those three are totally out of alignment.
Like saying one thing while thinking another.
Exactly. While your body is fidgeting with a phone.
Totally guilty of that.
We all are. But Chang Weinong explains that Saputi is meticulously aligning these three avenues.
So how do those specific physical movements achieve that alignment?
Well, first, burying the right shoulder visually demonstrates that one is prepared to carry a burden.
Ah.
In this case, the heavier responsibility of the teaching he's about to receive. And in that culture, people normally acted with their right hand and led with their right foot.
Right.
So kneeling on the right knee signifies a total readiness for action. And then pressing the palms together, that indicates that they hold nothing else. The hands are entirely empty and receptive.
Well, it's kind of like rolling up your sleeves before getting to work, but with the added layer of making sure your hands are completely empty, like you aren't multitasking.
That's a perfect way to look at it.
Yeah.
The physical gestures purify the body's karma. The deep reverence expressed internally purifies the mind's karma. And the spoken request that is about to follow that purifies the mouth's karma.
Wow.
It is a complete undivided alignment of the human being.
I really love looking at the actual mechanism of how this works, because it isn't just about being polite. Our sources actually connect this ancient choreography to a modern psychological application called the intentional posture exercise.
Yes. The underlying logic holds up beautifully today.
Right. The idea is that before you start a significant daily task, maybe it's a deep work session or, I don't know, a difficult conversation, you pause to frankly center yourself.
Mm-hmm.
You adopt a deliberate, respectful physical posture. But how does like putting your knee on the ground or sitting up straight at a desk actually alter the cognitive process?
It comes down to the mind-body feedback loop. Your nervous system is constantly receiving signals from your physical posture.
Right, so I'm slouching.
Exactly. If you're slumped over, your brain receives signals associated with fatigue or defeat or passivity.
Okay.
But by adopting a deliberate, grounded physical posture, you are actually interrupting the brain's default mode network. You're sending a physical signal that breaks automatic thought loops.
Oh, wow.
You aren't just sitting. You're signaling to your nervous system that you are transitioning into a state of active, intentional reception. Pure conduct and physical grounding are strict prerequisites because they literally alter the brain's readiness to receive complex information.
Okay, so Saputi has rolled up his sleeve, he's grounded his knee, his hands are empty, and his nervous system is primed.
He is ready.
The physical space and the intention are locked in, so he finally breaks the silence. What exactly does a perfect student ask a perfect teacher?
So Saputi asks a three-part question. He says, if a son or daughter of a good family wants to give rise to the supreme awakening, how should they abide, how should they practice, and how should they control their thoughts?
Supreme awakening being the absolute highest goal, which, you know, can sound incredibly abstract to a modern listener.
It can, but the sources bring in a translation by Thich Nhat Hanh that grounds this beautifully.
Oh, I love his work. What does he say?
He interprets Saputi's goal of supreme awakening as the desire to protect all living beings.
Oh, that's beautiful.
It is. So he frames the question as, if I want to use my whole being to protect life, what methods and principles should I use?
That framing makes it so vital. It really takes the concept out of an ancient monastery and drops it right into our daily lives.
Absolutely.
Like, how do we protect our health, our families, our planet? It transforms a mystical quest into a deeply practical question about navigating a world full of suffering.
Yeah, and Kamala Shila's commentary breaks down the three parts of that practical question, basically mapping them to the three stages of any spiritual or developmental journey.
Okay, let's go through them.
First, how should they abide? Refers to the ground or the foundation. Like, what is the fundamental stance the mind should take?
Right.
Second, how should they practice? Refers to the method. How do you actually walk through the world and interact with people?
And the third.
And third, how should they control their thoughts?
Mm-hmm.
Refers to the fruition. That's the daily maintenance and purification of the mind so that wisdom can actually take root.
You know, it makes me think of an analogy. It is exactly like setting a compass and asking for a map.
Ooh, I like that.
Right. Sukhuti first confirms the destination with his compass. He says, I want to reach unsurpassed awakening. That is the true north. And then he asks for the map. How do I stand firmly on this ground? How do I proceed forward? And how do I deal with the internal weather, you know, the wandering thoughts along the way?
The compass and map analogy captures the utility of the question perfectly.
Yeah.
And actually, the specific words used for that map in various translations, they create a fascinating paradox.
Really? Like what?
Well, the commentators, Ting Fu Pao and Vasu Bandhu, dive deeply into the tension between the original Sanskrit and the Chinese translations.
The nuances between the languages always reveal so much. So what is the tension there?
Well, the Sanskrit word used for abide is statavya, which literally translates to stand.
Stand, okay.
But the Chinese translation uses chu, which means to dwell. And for practice, the Sanskrit is pratipatavyan, which heavily implies walking or proceeding along a path.
So the literal translation of the question is, how do I stand and how do I walk?
Exactly. And Tang Pu Pao points out that this phrasing introduces a massive philosophical puzzle.
Why is it a puzzle?
Because, according to the foundational teachings, a true seeker of awakening, a bodhisattva, does not stand or dwell in the phenomenal everyday world of life and death, which is called samsara.
Right. That tracks with everything you hear about non-attachment. You're trying to transcend the mundane world of greed and anger.
Exactly. But the paradox is that because they're driven by boundless compassion to save all beings, they also absolutely refuse to stand or hide away in the absolute peace of nirvana.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, they won't just escape into a spiritual void while others are still suffering.
Wait, I need to make sure I'm following this. If they refuse to stand in the messy physical world because of non-attachment,
right,
and they refuse to stand in the perfect, peaceful world out of compassion, then, I mean, where do they stand?
That is the exact paradox Subhuti is presenting.
Where
is the ground for someone who refuses to be attached to either the physical world or the spiritual void? It is the ultimate puzzle of what is called the middle way. Like, how do you engage fully with everything in life without clinging to any of it?
So he's essentially asking for a map to a place that technically isn't a place you can plant your feet.
Pretty much.
We have this perfect student who has flawlessly purified his body and mind, asking a seemingly impossible question, but the commentaries don't let us just stop there and ponder the paradox, right?
No, they go way deeper.
They introduce a massive twist about the nature of the student himself and the very mind he's trying so hard to control.
Yeah, this is the moment the commentaries move from the physical and ethical layers into the absolute ultimate layer of the teaching.
Okay, strap in.
The sources introduce a concept from the Gelugpa tradition known as the 7-point analytical search.
Yeah, I read the section in the sources and found it incredibly dense. How does this analytical search actually work? Like, we have Subhuti kneeling on the ground. Let's apply it to him.
Okay, let's do it. The analytical search is a mechanical tool used to deconstruct our assumption of reality. We apply it to the practitioner, to Subhuti himself, to find the self that is asking the question.
Okay.
The tradition lays out 7 specific ways we might define a solid, independent student. Let's test a few of them.
That's good.
First, is Subhuti his parts? Like, is he his right shoulder, or his folded hands, or his anxious thoughts?
No, obviously not. I mean, if he loses an arm, he's still Subhuti.
Right. Okay, second point of the search. Is Subhuti merely the collection of his parts?
Well, if you put all his physical pieces and memories into a pile, it's just a pile of biological material and passing thoughts.
Exactly.
It doesn't inherently form a person just by being a collection, the same way, you know, a pile of car parts in a junkyard isn't a functioning car.
Brilliant analogy. Let's try the third point. Is Subhuti something entirely separate from his parts? Like, if we completely remove his body and completely remove his thoughts and feelings, is there a floating, independent Subhuti hovering in the room?
No, there's nothing left to point to.
Right. And you can continue this search through the remaining points, asking if the self possesses the parts, or if the parts contain the self, or the self is just a specific shape.
And the results.
The conclusion of the 7-point search is always the same. If you search for the permanent, independent essence of the student within his physical and mental parts, you absolutely cannot find him.
Wow.
The solid, independent seeker doesn't actually exist from its own side.
So if there is no inherent saputi to be found, what does that mean for the mind he is trying to control?
This leads to the intuitive logic of immediate negation, which is really the core formula of the Diamond Cutter Sutra.
Okay, what's the formula?
It's often summarized as A is not A, therefore it is called A.
Wait, what?
Let's apply that to the mind Saputi is asking how to control. The mind is not a fixed, inherently existing thing. If you use the 7-point search to locate a permanent mind, you can't find it.
Right.
Because it is not a solid, unchanging block. It is not a mind.
Okay, wait. I need to push back heavily here.
Go for it.
This sounds a lot like philosophical wordplay. If a mind isn't a mind, how can we even talk about it? If there is no student and there is no mind, then who exactly is feeling the heavy pressure to practice perfectly right now?
That's the big question.
I mean, who is the one getting stressed out about paying taxes or being a good person?
The commentators anticipate that exact anxiety. The framework they use to explain this is the doctrine of the two truths, ultimate reality and conventional reality.
Okay, break that down for me.
Ultimately, if you search for the rigid, stressed out, permanent you, it doesn't exist. That is the emptiness that cuts through our delusions.
Okay.
But conventionally, on the level of everyday life, you do function. The label works.
So the label is just a useful shortcut, not a permanent truth.
Yes. When you realize that you aren't a fixed, solid block, you realize that you have the capacity to change.
Oh, that's incredibly freeing.
It is. You aren't permanently flawed or permanently anxious or permanently anything. The pressure dissolves because you realize you aren't trying to fix a broken, unchangeable machine. You are just learning to navigate a constantly flowing river.
Wow.
Because the mind is fluid and empty of a fixed identity, we can conventionally label it a mind. Therefore, it is merely called a mind.
This transforms a simple question into a complete house of mirrors. Like, we have this single verse, this one moment of asking for help, and the commentaries are telling us it can be understood on multiple levels simultaneously.
Yes, the beauty of verse 2 is that it operates on 4 distinct levels at the exact same time.
Let's recap them.
First, you have the conceptual level. This is the literal narrative reading. A student is raising his hand and asking a teacher how to control wandering thoughts.
Which is deeply practical. We all need to know how to deal with distraction.
Right. But look closer, and you find the analytical level. The physical gestures represent the total purification of the karma of body, speech, and mind.
Right, rolling up the sleeves.
But at the exact same time, applying the analytical search reveals that the self performing these purified actions is ultimately unfindable.
And then we move to the framework of the path itself,
which is the meditative level. The 3-part question encompasses the entire architecture of the spiritual path, establishing the ground, practicing the method, and realizing the fruition.
The compass setting the destination and the map showing the route.
Exactly. Which inevitably leads to the practical or ultimate level.
Yeah.
The request reveals the profound paradox that true abiding, true standing in the middle way requires dwelling absolutely nowhere.
Right.
It's engaging with immense compassion without clinging to a single concept.
So what does this all mean for us today? We started this deep dive by visualizing a master craftsman working in perfect silence and an apprentice finally gathering the courage to ask for the secret.
Mm-hmm.
By isolating this single moment of inquiry in verse 2 of the Diamond Cutter Sutra, we've unpacked an incredible journey.
We really have. We observed the profound realization of a silent routine where everyday tasks become a teaching in unattached awareness.
Right.
We explored the meticulous physical purification of body, speech, and mind, and how intentional posture literally primes the nervous system for truth.
We saw how asking the ultimate question, how to abide, practice, and control our thoughts, is really asking for the map to navigate the suffering of the world without being swallowed by it.
And finally, we use the 7-point analytical search to dismantle the seeker entirely, realizing that the student asking the question and the mind being sought are entirely fluid.
This is the best news ever.
It is. They are not fixed blocks, which means they are capable of infinite transformation.
It is a staggering amount of wisdom packed into the simple act of taking a knee and asking for help, So I want to leave you with a final thought to mull over today, just a way to take this ancient commentary and apply it to your afternoon.
I love this.
The next time you feel completely overwhelmed by the pressure to control your thoughts, or, you know, you feel that heavy anxiety that you need to somehow fix your broken mind, try applying that 7-point search.
Yes.
Stop and ask yourself, if you meticulously search your physical body and your fleeting mental states, can you actually locate the solid, permanent you that is supposedly failing? Or are you just temporarily holding on to a rigid label that is causing you unnecessary suffering?
That's such a powerful question.
Before you tackle your next big task or difficult conversation, take a cue from Subhuti. Check your physical posture. Put your feet on the ground and empty your hands to signal to your brain that you are ready. Set your compass to your highest intention of protecting life. But as you ask for the map, remember the ultimate lesson of the Silent Master. The path works best when you travel completely light, carrying nothing but an empty, open mind.